This is an ABC podcast.
This is the Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick.
These laws are nation-leading laws, and it's terrific to see Queensland seeking to stamp out this practice of claims farming, which is so detrimental to the personal injury claims industry.
The methodology that's been used is a bit like using a sledgehammer to open a peanut. It's the unintended consequences that are the problem.
Queensland's crackdown on claim farming. Also, a new study finds that there's no consistency in when and how judges reduce prison sentences because of intense media coverage.
We need to move to a space where courts aren't constantly having to say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this, but I'm going to have to figure it out in this case, and hopefully someone else figures it out in the future.
First, new trailblazing legislation in Queensland is designed to stop claim farming. It's a practice where the public are cold called and encouraged to make compensation claims. Since 2019, Queensland has had legislation banning the practice for motor accident insurance claims. But these new laws extend this ban to personal injury and workers' compensation. Brisbane personal injury lawyer Michelle James is national head of the abuse law practice with Maurice Blackburn, and she's a former Queensland head of the Australian Lawyers Alliance. She welcomes the new laws. Michelle James, what exactly is claim farming?
There's no uniform definition of claims farming, but generally it's understood to be the practice of cold calling people and inducing or inciting them to bring claims for compensation across various regimes. So it could be in the motor accident space, it could be in the workers' compensation space, or indeed any form of personal injuries. And more recently, we've seen this practice particularly abhorrent in the abuse law space. So contacting survivors of sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse, and encouraging them to make a claim. And we've seen instances, for example, of very personal information about such an awful thing to happen as a child being disclosed without consent to law firms, who then try and incite people to make claims.
What sort of harm does claims farming cause to, say, potential litigants or to the broader system?
There are many harms from claims farming. So thinking first of all about the insurance that covers these various claims, inducing people to make claims in this way unfortunately increases fraudulent claims. And that, of course, has an impact on the sustainability of the insurance schemes which underpin all forms of personal injury claims. Secondly, of course, then, you know, there is the nuisance factor of being cold called and trying to being induced to make a claim. In the abuse space in particular, of course, there's that re-traumatisation aspect as well. So across the board, it's a very damaging practice.
Now, prior to 2019, more than 1.5 million Queenslanders were cold called with respect to compulsory third-party motor vehicle accident claims. This led to a ban on claim farming in this sector. How big a problem was claim farming in that space, and how effective has that 2019 legislation been?
Well, it was a prolific practice in the CTP space, and we know from records kept by the Motor Accident Insurance Commission in Queensland that they had seen a spike in claims, particularly in those sort of lower value type claims that really came out of nowhere. And they keep a very close eye on that scheme and were concerned about this practice. And through their advocacy, these laws were brought in, and almost immediately we saw a drop in those claims that really had come out of nowhere, firms that had never really practiced in this space before. We saw those sorts of claims, particularly at the lower end, drop off. And so those laws have been very effective.
So those laws around claims farming and motor accident and compulsory third-party claims have been on the books since 2019. And Queensland has just passed new laws, which have taken effect this month, which extend the ban on claims farming to all personal injuries and workers' compensation cases.
Queensland has really shown excellent leadership in this area. The Queensland Government and the Attorney General in particular have really taken it upon themselves to stamp out this abhorrent practice of claims farming. So whilst other jurisdictions around the country do have other smaller prohibitions on paying for referral fees. No other jurisdiction in Australia has really taken this step of really stamping out the practice by these laws.
What are the issues around claim farming specific to claims of historical sexual abuse? I understand that there are organisations that are involved in this space and would argue that they're doing outreach work, survivor support work, that they're simply trying to recover some of their expenses as they go out into the community and support people and inform people about their rights. What's your view around those sorts of organisations?
So firstly, any organisation that is quite genuinely set up to provide advice or outreach or other support services to survivors of childhood sexual abuse is to be welcomed. What is of concern are organisations who badge themselves or brand themselves as providing those services, when in fact, if you look behind the veneer of how they say they operate, they in fact do nothing of the sort. And in fact, what they do is they will cold call or approach or solicit people, often with confidential information that they've received from other sources, and try to hear their story, where the person providing that information may believe that they are providing information for the purposes of getting other services and other support. And in fact, the organisation is seeking to package up that information and provide it to a law firm for a fee.
And would you say, though, that it's a clear black and white line, or there's sort of a grey zone here between providing outreach support and the claims farming that you're talking about here?
Well, outreach support should be aimed at providing survivors of child sexual abuse with services such as counselling services, financial counselling services, other medical type treatment, or information about legal rights, for example, under the National Redress Scheme, as well as under civil law. What it shouldn't be is the taking of something that purports to be a statement and then selling that information onto a law firm for a fee, sometimes quite a large fee.
Brisbane personal injury lawyer Peter Carter, director of Carter Kapner Law, is a former national president of the Australian Lawyers Alliance. He has a different view of this new law. He wants to make it clear that he opposes claim farming, but says the legislation imposes new and counterproductive restrictions on the widespread long-standing practice of fee sharing, where one lawyer refers a client to another lawyer.
I can't pay a lawyer who wants to refer me a case because of my expertise. He'd prefer not to handle it, wants to refer it on. Normally he'd share in the fees, or quite often he'd share in the fees that I would generate in consideration of the referral. Now that practice is banned. So that's an undesirable consequence, because it means that lawyer's client won't be getting potentially the best representation they could get. The solicitor himself might be, in those circumstances, incentivized to run it himself, and that's not in the best interest. It prevents the system of cases going to the best qualified people to run them.
So you're saying, if I understand you, that, you know, somebody goes to their local solicitor and says, look, I've just had an accident, what are my options here? That lawyer has a consultation with them and on reflection thinks, yeah, I better send them to somebody who specialises in this work. They do that, and there's normally a sort of a fee arrangement for the referral of that kind of work.
Yes, exactly. A share in the fees that are ultimately generated, or a payment up front. So that practice is banned. Legitimate claims, no question of claim farming. Why do they need to ban that practice?
And what percentage of your clients, you're a personal injury lawyer, are referred to you or handed on to you by other lawyers, you know, with these sorts of fee arrangements?
Well, probably 25% from other lawyers, and, you know, a large number of those have that sort of arrangement associated with them. Some lawyers don't seek it, but many others do. And indeed is permitted under the Australian Solicitors Conduct Rules, which apply in Queensland. The legislation is trailblazing to that extent, but my complaint is how far it goes. Not only does it ban solicitors from paying their colleagues for a legitimate referral on a proper basis, another provision of the Act says that you can't although the heading to the section says it's a ban on approaching someone to solicit or induce them to make a claim, that's not what the section says, and that's not what the ban is. The ban is you cannot approach and induce someone to make a claim.
What scenarios do you envisage which might be of concern for you?
Very ordinary social scenarios at a barbecue, or, you know, if I'm in a bar on Friday night, someone asks, what do you do? And I explain, and they bring up something about them. I would have to leave that conversation, because otherwise I could be said to be inducing them to make a claim by explaining to them their rights. That's an extraordinary ban on ordinary discourse and ordinary social interaction. If it came to the attention of the regulator, I could be severely dealt with for.
Again, we really don't know. We're crystal ball gazing about how these laws might be interpreted.
I beg to differ. It's not an interpretation question. If they wanted to avoid that interpretation, they would have framed the section that it was a ban on people approaching for the purpose of inducing or soliciting someone to make a claim. But they haven't said that. They've said approach person and. So it's just two things. You approach, walk across the bar, then and in the conversation. That's the offence I would be committing. Even if it's not prosecuted, I'm a lawyer. I don't like committing offences, and I shouldn't be committing an offence just by having regular social discourse in a social situation.
Michelle James does not think the new laws will prevent conversations in social settings and says she welcomes the ban on fee-sharing arrangements between lawyers.
Well, Mr. Carter's entitled to his view, but what I would say is that these laws were wholeheartedly supported by the broader profession. The Queensland Law Society and the Australian Lawyers Alliance both unanimously supported these laws and this legislation. There's nothing stopping a practitioner who receives an inquiry about a personal injuries matter who doesn't have the required expertise to be able to bring that claim. There is nothing stopping them passing those details onto a law firm or a professional colleague who does have that expertise. What has been stopped is the practice of paying a fee for those referrals of more than $200. And I welcome these laws. The Australian Lawyers Alliance welcomes the laws, and the Queensland Law Society welcomes the laws.
Peter Carter says, look, without these payments, some lawyers might try to go it alone rather than refer on to lawyers who are better placed to handle these sorts of claims because they don't necessarily have the requisite expertise. And that will mean worse outcomes for victims, for survivors, for potential litigants.
I don't share that view. All lawyers, of course, are heavily regulated, and we all understand our professional obligations to practice really in an area that we have some expertise. So we can't say that his fears will not be realised, but my view is that that's a very low risk, that no lawyer would, or most lawyers wouldn't seek to practice in an area as complex as personal injuries with the risks associated with practice in that area unless they had that expertise. And in my view, the removal of this practice of paying for a fee-sharing type arrangement, I just don't see the risks that Mr. Carter is fearful of being realised as being realised as part of these new laws.
Peter Carter says these laws contain prohibitions on certain forms of communicating about what services you offer. He says under the new laws it makes it an offence to approach another person and solicit them to make a claim. And this language is very broad and could include, you know, somebody you might meet in a social situation or down at the pub where they ask you what you do and they ask you questions about their rights and what their situation might be.
There's nothing in this legislation that prohibits in a social setting, if somebody asks you a question about bringing a personal injury claim, there's nothing in these laws, in my interpretation of them, that precludes you from providing them with advice. In fact, that's what we do as personal injury lawyers. When people approach us and ask us questions about their rights, we're able to provide them with that advice.
Moving away from this new claim farming legislation, what are the laws around advertising for legal services in Queensland and I guess more broadly around the country?
Queensland and Western Australia have a very similar system restricting advertising in the personal injury field to print advertisements, billboards that refer only to your name, your practice areas and your contact details. On their website, you can also include other things if it's your own website, including and they are the name of a person's rights in the case of a personal injury and the terms on which you conduct the claim. For example, no win, no fee. So that's what happens in Queensland. New South Wales, it's largely unrestricted. That restriction, it was restriction, but the restriction was substantially removed in 2015. And in Victoria, there are only the restrictions that are contained in the conduct rules, which is inoffensive and inappropriate unethical advertising. So the Queensland, again, has the strictest regime for advertising. And there's an argument for relaxing the advertising rules if in the context of this claim farming legislation, so ordinary consumers can be better informed about their rights by people who are genuinely practicing in the area, not by claims farmers.
When it comes to advertising restrictions, Peter Carter and Michelle James are on the same page.
So it's been the case for some several years, since the early 2000s, that personal injury lawyers are prevented from saying certain things about the services that they provide. And these laws were written at a time where digital and technological ways of interacting were nowhere near as prevalent as they are today. They were written in an era before smartphones, for example, and where websites were nowhere near as interactive and perhaps the first source of information that many people are used to going to these days. So for a long time, personal injuries lawyers and law firms have not been able to educate the broader community about their legal rights in this area. And we say, Maurice Blackburn would say, that the laws are just not fit for contemporary practice, where we're very used to obtaining information these days on our smartphones or from the internet. And so certainly we welcome the Parliamentary Committee's view that there should be a review of these advertising regulations that exist in Queensland to see whether they in fact are fit for purpose in a modern and more contemporary digital age, and whether in fact they serve any purpose at all, or whether, to the contrary, rather than being a good and a helpful thing, they in fact operate as a means of affecting access to justice, because those who've been injured can't legitimately find out what their rights are.
Michelle James, National Head of the Abuse Law Practice at Maurice Blackburn and a former Queensland Head of the Australian Lawyers Alliance. And before her, Peter Carter, Director of Carter Kapner Law, a former National President of the Australian Lawyers Alliance. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on RN, available anytime as a podcast from all the usual platforms or, of course, from the wonderful ABC Listen app. When sentencing serious offenders, judges sometimes reduce prison time because of tough media coverage. Well, a new study has found that there doesn't appear to be much consistency around this practice, and the legal system would definitely benefit from clearer guidance on when and how this should be done. Dr. Paul McGorry, the CEO of the Victorian Sentencing Advisory Council, is the report's author. Dr. McGorry, you looked at cases from all around the countries over a 20-year period. How many cases did you look at?
So we found 43 cases. What we did was we reviewed as many cases as we could find where an Australian court has tried to grapple this issue that you've raised about whether and how much media coverage should affect a sentence imposed on an offender. We weren't trying to be exhaustive in our case review, but we did look as hard as we could. What we were trying to do was better understand the issues involved.
And in a nutshell, what did you find?
Effectively, we found some inconsistency. Most cases involve courts reducing a person's sentence as a result of media coverage for a number of reasons. But there are some cases where they're not doing that as well.
Why would you? I mean, what's the rationale? Why should judges consider the impact of media coverage?
So sentencing is a very complex task. And there's this concept in sentencing that we like to call extracurial punishment. That's just a fancy way of saying that someone has been punished in some fashion outside of the justice system, extracurially, as a result of their crimes. Now, extracurial punishment can take many forms. Some people lose their jobs. Some people lose their visas and get deported. For some people who are sent to prison, their family will experience hardship because they've lost a key source of income. But most relevantly for what we're talking about today, Extracurial punishment can include media coverage about someone's case, which in the modern age of 24-hour news cycles, cancel culture, and trolling on social media can be quite a grueling experience.
Yeah, but if you've actually committed a serious offence, assuming that your convictions aren't subsequently overturned, you are guilty of those offences, and therefore, so you experience harm, embarrassment, shame, whatever, as a result of the media coverage. That's part of the course, isn't it?
And that's what courts have been saying. They've been saying that usually they'll only be taking this into account where there's something more than what's natural and probable. It has to go above and beyond. So we found there's usually four reasons that will go above and beyond that will mean a court will give someone a reduced sentence. It can be extreme stigmatization. We saw it. Some offenders became recluses, socially isolated because of the community backlash that they saw. We saw some people with actual community backlash. There was one person down in Tasmania found guilty of particularly heinous animal cruelty offending. The community responded with thousands of death threats on his Facebook page, and he became a recluse as well. And the third reason is psychological consequences. Some people can become quite devastated by the effect of media coverage on them. And the fourth and final reason, which is quite interesting, is when the media coverage has a sensational or mischaracterized nature about it, and it somehow blows everything out of proportion.
Let's come to those sorts of cases in a moment. I'm assuming a lot of these cases where lawyers try to argue on behalf of their clients for a reduced prison time, we're talking about offenders who are high profile. What were some of the cases in that category that you looked at?
It's interesting because some of these high profile cases, the courts are saying you were in a position of trust, so you're not entitled to a discount. One example of that would be a New South Wales MP who was found guilty of corruption. And the court said that the media should be reporting on political corruption because it's a matter of public importance. So they weren't going to give that MP a discount as a result of the media coverage. On the flip side, there's a couple of other cases involving a sitting magistrate and a sitting judge in Victoria and New South Wales. Now, in the Victorian case, a sitting magistrate about 10 years ago was found guilty of indecently assaulting children in the mid-1980s. There was a lot of media coverage about this case because he was a magistrate, someone we expect to show the highest standards of behaviour. Now, the court sentencing him had to figure out whether that media coverage entitled him to a reduced sentence. And I don't usually like to do this, direct quotes, but what the court said was really important here. Widespread publicity concerning crimes committed by people with important public responsibilities is entirely proper. It spreads the message throughout the community that persons who are popular, important, well-known or privileged are not free to commit crimes and will not escape detection, prosecution and appropriate punishment. But despite those comments, the court still reduced his sentence, saying that his fall from grace was more extensive than it would have been for someone else found guilty of the same offences.
Mm. Listeners might think, well, you're right. They were in a position of trust and they abused that power. Of course, people are going to highlight that. And the media is going to highlight that, and that comes with the territory of being an offender.
Absolutely. So what we've tried to do, this paper is about should media coverage affect sentencing, and if so, why and how much. What we found was inconsistency.
So we had this case of the former Crown prosecutor who became a magistrate, and then it was taken into account, his sentence. But then you had the other case, I think in 2009, of a very prominent New South Wales judge who was found guilty of perjury. I think he kind of, he lied about a parking ticket. He was the subject of enormous media attention. Was that taken into account in his sentence?
Now, this is one of the most interesting cases in the whole batch because it was a judge who infamously lied under oath to try and get out of a $77 speeding ticket. Now, the sentencing court originally did reduce his sentence to reflect the devastating psychological effect the media coverage about his case had on him. But he then appealed his sentence and the appeal court had more to say on it. And they said, yes, okay, there should be some discount for the media coverage. But on the flip side, the sentence also needs to be increased because what you did was breaching your position of trust, that the public were entitled to count on you being a person of good character. So the same thing that caused the enhanced media coverage and reduced his sentence also increased his sentence. So I think in the end, it all probably balanced out.
Does living in a small town have an impact on how these issues might be considered?
It can, I think, is the answer. Not always, but what we saw in some cases were recognition that coverage in your local newspaper, so if you live in a less populous area, can have a drastic effect if you live in a town with a small population, because everyone knows you, everyone talks about it, and then the consequences of that small amount of media coverage can have a big effect on you. But if you're living in a place like Melbourne or Sydney, it might be that media coverage in a local newspaper doesn't affect you as much as it would have for that other person in a smaller town.
There was another very interesting case involving, well, the daughter of a former New South Wales Premier. I know you're reluctant to use names, but it'll be pretty obvious to most people in Sydney who we're talking about. What happened to her?
As you said, it was the daughter of a former New South Wales Premier who was prosecuted for murder originally, but eventually was sentenced for being an accessory to murder. She was with two men and entered another man's home to try and steal drugs and money. Now, unbeknownst to her, the two men that she was with attacked the man, stabbing him, and he later died. Now, the media coverage about the case was extreme, and to be honest, that's putting it mildly. There were claims that she had willingly taken part in the planned murder, when in fact it turned out she didn't know what they were trying to do. She had her private correspondence published in newspapers, her phone calls transcribed and reenacted for listeners. There were claims of a sex and drug binge after the murder that never happened. Now, she was eventually found guilty, as I said, but of a very different crime. And in retrospect, that made all of the media coverage, which was already quite disproportionate, even more excessively disproportionate. The court itself described the media coverage about that case as egregious, as damaging, and what's worse for sentencing, as impeding her ability to address her underlying mental health and drug issues.
So she got a reduction in her sentence?
Yes.
A substantial one?
We'll never know because these things aren't quantified, but judging by the language in the judgment, I would assume so.
All right. So we've got this lack of clarity, this messy situation, and you say we could benefit from consistency and guidance. What form should that take?
It's really open what form the guidance could take. On the one hand, you could enact legislation that specifies how courts should be grappling with this issue. On the other hand, a useful approach in common law jurisdictions like Australia is for an appeal court to hear arguments on this issue, reasoned discussion, and issue some guidance for courts in their jurisdiction about how it should be handled. If it's in the High Court, that would apply Australia-wide. But whatever form the guidance takes, I think we need to move to a space where courts aren't constantly having to say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this, but I'm going to have to figure it out in this case, and hopefully someone else figures it out in the future.
Yeah, that sounds like a far from ideal situation. Dr. Paul McGorry, CEO of the Victorian Sentencing Advisory Council, thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
Thanks so much, Damien.
That's The Law Report for this week. A big thank you to producer Christina Coccolia and also to technical producer Elise Simons. Don't forget, the program is available as a podcast from all your favourite platforms or, of course, from the ABC Listen app. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.